Thank you very much, Justin. It has been 23 years, that's revolting. I want to thank the Kahn Institute very much for this very kind invitation to come lecture this afternoon and to speak with you again tomorrow on the question of evil in the work of Hannah Arendt. This is a daunting question. In Arendt's work, to speak of the question of evil is to speak of a lengthy path of thinking, a notoriously winding path marked by numerous complicated twists and turns, and at least the appearance of a single decisive break or reversal. And I hope I have a chance tomorrow at our colloquium to talk a little bit about the break in Arendt's thinking. That is to say, the idea that she first embraced an idea of radical evil, then renounced or reversed herself, and came to adopt a position on what she called the banality of evil. But my concern this afternoon is with Arendt's early engagement with the question of evil, and with the thorny question of radical evil. Early in 1951, just prior to the publication of her sprawling study on the origins of totalitarianism, Arendt sent a copy of the work to her friend and teacher, Karl Jaspers. After a cursory reading of it, Jaspers wrote back with warm praise for his pupil, declaring, "I've never yet seen the situation and task of our time presented so clearly and vividly." But he concluded his letter with the simple question, "Hasn't Yahweh faded too far out of sight?" In her next letter, Arendt acknowledged to Jaspers that, "Your question has been on my mind for weeks now, without my being able to come up with an answer to it." But in lieu of an answer, she offered an important and oft-cited clarification. "Evil," she wrote, "has proved to be more radical than expected. In objective terms, modern crimes are not provided for in the Ten Commandments. Or the Western tradition is suffering from the preconception that the most evil things human beings can do arise from the vice of selfishness. Yet we know that the greatest evils, or radical evil, has nothing to do anymore with such humanly understandable, sinful motives. What radical evil really is, I don't know, but it seems to me that it has something to do with the following phenomenon: making human beings as human beings superfluous. Not using them as means to an end, which leaves their essence as humans untouched and impinges only on their human dignity. Rather, making them superfluous as human beings. This happens as soon as all unpredictability, which in human beings is the equivalent of spontaneity, is eliminated." These remarks, which contain in condensed form the heart of Arendt's early doctrine of radical evil, raise a number of crucial questions for us. What does Arendt mean when she claims that the greatest evils cannot be traced back to humanly understandable motives? In a number of writings from this early period, she repeatedly rejects any attempts to understand the greatest evils by reference to the motives of self-interest, greed, covetousness, resentment, lust for power, and cowardice. In rejecting such motives, does she mean to say that the motives that informed the actions of the concentration camp administrators, for instance, are so dark, are lodged so deeply in the human heart, that they cannot be brought to light? And in this case, does the darkness at issue refer to the actual content of the motives, or to the limitations of our own powers of discernment? In ruling out humanly understandable motives, is Arendt hinting at a motive beyond such motives, something akin, perhaps, to the supreme maxim that informs Kant's late doctrine of radical evil, a motive which would precede and inform every positive moral or immoral act, and for this very reason would be called radical? On a different note, what does it mean to, quote, make human beings as human beings superfluous? If, as Arendt says, radical evil does not merely destroy the dignity of human beings, which is accomplished, as Kant has shown, the moment human beings are reduced to mere means, but impinges on their very essence, how precisely is this essence understood by her? How is it bound up with unpredictability or spontaneity? And how can spontaneity itself, or the capacity for spontaneous action, be singled out as the target of a political experiment? These questions, which could easily be multiplied, provide us with a jumping-off point for an engagement with Arendt's early doctrine of radical evil. This engagement must invariably be an engagement with totalitarianism and its aspiration to what she calls total domination. For as she repeatedly points out, it is only in the final stages of totalitarianism that, quote, the truly radical nature of evil comes to light. and therefore we have no choice but to dwell on the horrors of the concentration camp if we wish to come to terms with radical evil. But in dwelling on horrors, we are immediately confronted with a problem. We say that we wish to come to terms with radical evil, but what does this mean? Can one simply assume that there are terms for the phenomenon in question? The very idea that one can and should come to terms with the camps suggests the possibility of understanding what happened, and in turn, of reconciling ourselves to what happened. The link between understanding and reconciliation finds expression in the familiar French expression, tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. To understand all is to forgive all. The danger, then, is that by coming to terms with Auschwitz, by coming to understand what happened there, if this is possible, we will thereby reconcile ourselves to it. Arendt responds to this danger by distinguishing between the reconciliation that is inherent to understanding and the reconciliation bound up with forgiveness. Forgiving, she tells us, is a single, one-time act. It punctuates or interrupts a course of events in order to undo what has been done and to provide a remedy for some earlier action. Understanding, by contrast, is not a single act. Understanding begins with birth and ends with death. Or as Arendt will put it following Heidegger, understanding is the specifically human way of being alive. Yes, it is true that understanding does have a reconciling effect, but, and this is crucial, it does not reconcile us to any particular deed or event or person. It does not condone or forgive anything. Rather, understanding reconciles us to the world itself. Arendt writes, quote, to the extent that the rise of totalitarian governments is the central event of our world, to understand totalitarianism is not to condone anything, but to reconcile ourselves to a world in which such things are possible at all. And this is a very important clarification. It implies that the real object of trying to come to terms with totalitarianism is not theoretical at all, but existential. We must come to understand what happened, not in order to theorize about evil, but, as Arendt says, to love the world again. After Auschwitz, there is a very real danger that we will despair of the world, and in Arendt's view, we need to understand what happened in order to combat this tendency, in order to make possible a manner of being alive that is reconciled to the world, that assumes its worldliness as a gift and not as a burden. As for forgiveness, things are more difficult. I'll say something about this if there's time at the end of this lecture, and certainly tomorrow afternoon, but that is not my topic this afternoon. I suggested that Arendt's letter to Jaspers contained, in crystallized form, the heart of her early doctrine of radical evil. But as Arendt scholars have very often pointed out, there's no simple doctrine of radical evil to be found in her work. There are, in fact, three determinations of radical evil discoverable in her early writings. So let me list them. One, radical evil is incomprehensible, or as she says, it is not traceable to humanly comprehensible motives. Two, radical evil is strictly unpunishable and therefore unforgivable. And three, radical evil aims at nothing less than to render living human beings superfluous. These, then, are the three determinations of radical evil, or the markers of its radicality for Arendt. But having named them, we are as yet far from understanding them. Nowhere in her work does Arendt explicitly bring together, let alone order, the multiple senses of radical evil. Indeed, since each of the determinations is emphasized or muted at different times in her early reflections on evil, depending on the itinerary and argumentative needs of the text at hand, it falls to the student of her work to trace their formation and transformation over the course of her theorizing. A comprehensive account of her notion of radical evil would require one to canvass thoroughly the various writings of the late 1940s and early 1950s, and perhaps also the later theoretical writings, such as The Human Condition, where Arendt provides a single instructive reference to radical evil, and The Life of the Mind, in which radical evil has supposedly been abandoned in favor of the banality of evil, but in which text the sense of superfluity finds its clearest and most far-reaching articulation. I'm going to limit myself for the remainder of this lecture to a much more modest undertaking than that. Leaving the first two determinations, which have received the lion's share of attention from students of Arendt's work, wholly out of account, I will focus exclusively on the last of them, on the, quote, rendering superfluous of living human beings, and on the political conditions under which such an operation becomes possible at all. Since, as we'll see, the conditions in question are unique to totalitarianism, it is Arendt's original doctrine of totalitarianism and of total domination that will occupy us. When it was first published in 1951, after five long years of research and work, The Origins of Totalitarianism was met with a mixture of admiration, mystification, and outrage. From the very beginning, it sparked heated debates among historians, philosophers, and political scientists. At the center of the firestorm was Arendt's controversial thesis, which has come to be called the totalitarian thesis, according to which Nazism and Stalinism are essentially similar regimes. Regimes, therefore, which cannot be understood in strictly national terms, that is, against the backdrop of specifically German or Russian traditions, cultures, or institutions, but must rather be grasped against the horizon of wider political and economic tendencies in modern life. In making this case, Arendt singled out a number of elements which she claimed crystallized in the formation of the new regimes. These elements, this is very important, are not to be confused with causes. As she insisted repeatedly in her early writing, quote, causality is an altogether alien and falsifying category in the historical sciences. But these elements were rather to be understood as enabling conditions, without which the emergence of the new regimes would scarcely have been possible. So not causes, but conditions in the absence of which the new regimes would not have been possible. The elements in question were anti-Semitism, the decay of the nation state, expansion for expansion's sake, racism, and a new and unsettling alliance between capital and the mob. By singling out these elements and tracing their historical careers on the European stage, Arendt wished to challenge the popular prejudice, according to which Nazism and Stalinism were either mysterious outgrowths of the national character of Germany and Russia, or else politicized expressions of the demonic genius of Hitler or Stalin. The elements in question were well-known social and economic strains of the 19th and early 20th century, and, this is a very controversial claim, they were equally available to every country in Europe, regardless of its national traditions. If, as it turned out, they could be amalgamated and exploited by totalitarian regimes in Germany and Russia, this had less to do with the local political traditions of those countries than with larger processes of social and economic modernization, processes which threatened to close off the institutionally articulated spaces of human freedom, which stand as the only genuine bulwark against the spread of evil on a mass scale. Although Arendt did not provide a theoretical defense of her theory of elements, or at least not in the pages of totalitarianism, the image of crystallizing elements was intended to accommodate not only the non-national and impersonal character of the new regimes, but also their historical contingency. So that is to say, totalitarianism is not the logical or unavoidable consummation of some larger meta-historical process, like the unfolding of spirit, or of history, or of being. To have recourse to such grand narratives was to deny the terrible shock, the horrible originality, that in Arendt's view is the decisive feature of the event itself. As she puts it in the opening paragraphs of her book, quote, comprehension does not mean denying the outrageous, deducing the unprecedented from precedents, or explaining phenomena by such analogies and generalities that the impact of reality and the shock of experience are no longer felt. Her concrete analysis of the elements in question, an account which resolutely refuses to leave the plane of historical description in favor of philosophical speculation, and which focuses on the actual practices and policies of the new regimes rather than on the philosophical self-interpretation of the administrators, is intended, above all, to preserve this impact of reality and shock of experience. Over the course of her writings, this experiential scruple is never abandoned by Arendt, although it's gradually deepened as she moves from the historiographical register to the political theoretical one. Arendt's theory of totalitarianism was attacked on several fronts by critics of her study. some readers objected that by setting Stalin alongside Hitler under the heading of totalitarianism, and by deflecting attention away from specifically German traditions and onto Western modernity as such, Arendt was effectively exonerating German culture itself from its responsibility for the disaster. Others took exception with Arendt's almost exclusive attention to economic and political factors, and her relative indifference to the spiritual or ideological origins of the new regimes. Were there not certain very powerful strains in the spiritual history of Germany, for instance, 19th century German Romanticism, with its fateful distinction between a profound Kultur and shallow civilization, or its forceful critique of democratic institutions and its pervasive anti-Semitism, which had paved the way for the Nazi regime? On a different plane, it was objected that in her genealogy of the conditions of Nazism, Arendt had failed to foreground the tragic historical relation between the German and Jewish people. Indeed, she seemed to treat as non-essential the fact that it was the Jews as Jews who were targeted for extermination. But was this not an essential, perhaps the essential, feature of the Nazi regime? And finally, given the patent imbalance in Arendt's text, her patient examination of the subterranean antecedents of Nazism, such as anti-Semitism and racism, versus her relatively scant treatment of the more mainstream origins of Stalinism in the utopian philosophy and program of Karl Marx, was it not highly suspicious for Arendt to insist upon the essential proximity of the two regimes? Noting the date of its publication, leftist critics of the text denounced it as a piece of Cold War propaganda, an effort to discredit existing communist strains in the United States by attempting to demonstrate the essential similarity of the Soviet and Nazi regimes. These objections, to which others might be added, would all have to be addressed in order for us to understand the reception of Arendt's theory of totalitarianism by her contemporaries. But while they may help us to locate Arendt's place among the various polemical alternatives, they don't yet help us to understand what totalitarianism actually is. That is, what she calls the nature or essence of totalitarianism. And so, let us begin by asking, what does Arendt mean when she speaks of totalitarianism and totalitarian domination? In approaching these questions, it's important to follow Arendt's own example and adopt a stance of extreme theoretical humility. One must, for instance, resist the urge to present a simple and straightforward definition of totalitarianism. Arendt herself does not offer anything so ready to hand, and on the rare occasions when she explicitly considers the term, she balks at a definition for reasons essential to the phenomenon itself. So for instance, in the opening sentences of the 1954 essay, Understanding in Politics, she notes that in the case of totalitarianism, the very event, the phenomenon, which we try and must try to understand, has deprived us of our traditional tools of understanding. If this is indeed the case, and totalitarianism has deprived us of our traditional tools of understanding, this is because, as she goes on to say, it is a phenomenon that is absolutely without precedent. It is a novum in the political history of the West. And its chief characteristic is a horrible originality which no far-fetched historical parallels can alleviate. Arendt will never stop insisting upon the unprecedented and incomparable character of the totalitarian regimes. Indeed, she's so eager to foreground the radical difference of this new political form that her early writing on the subject often reads like a negative theology, filled with descriptions of what totalitarianism is not. And so we learn, it is not simply an updated form of authoritarianism or tyranny. It is not to be confused with traditional fascism. It is separated by an abyss from mere nihilism. It cannot be understood in its essence by comparison with any earlier form of domination. For although it makes use of various traditional forms of oppression, it alters them, she claims, beyond recognition. Its unprecedentedness, and specifically the unprecedentedness of the concentration camp, the most consequential institution of totalitarian rule, lies neither in the number of victims it claims, nor in the scale of its cruelties. And it not only constitutes a break with all our political traditions, but it explodes the very categories of political thought and standards of moral judgment with which we might try to comprehend. On the positive side, Arendt offers that, quote, the success of totalitarianism is identical with a much more radical liquidation of freedom as a political act and as a human reality than anything we have ever witnessed before. and she insists that this alone should be enough to mobilize opposition to it. But elsewhere points out that, quote, this denial of freedom is common to all tyrannies and is of no primary importance for understanding the peculiar nature of totalitarianism. As these negative determinations suggest, totalitarianism does not lend itself to easy definition. Nevertheless, if we bring together a number of the most important early writings, a positive determination of totalitarian rule does emerge. As Arendt presents it in these texts, totalitarianism is, quote, a political regime whose guiding principle is terror. A political regime whose guiding principle is terror. Following Montesquieu's insight that every form of government can be understood in terms of the innate principle which sets it into motion and guides all its actions, she argues that totalitarianism differs from traditional forms of authoritarian government in that its guiding principle, or its principle of action, is neither virtue, as in a republic, nor honor, as in a monarchy, nor fear, as in tyranny, but terror. Given the importance of this claim, we must pause to consider what it means, what terror, a technical term in Arendt's work, involves, and how its establishment as the innate principle of totalitarian rule separates the new form of political regime, as if by a chasm, from everything that came before. She begins her important essay on mankind and terror by observing that terror as a means of frightening people into submission can appear in an extraordinary variety of forms, and can be closely linked with a large number of political and party systems that have become familiar to us. From the ancient terror of tyrants, despots, and dictators to the modern examples of revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries, terror has long been employed as an effective means of political oppression and intimidation. This fact has been abundantly documented and is hardly controversial. What then can Arendt mean by singling out terror as the specific difference of totalitarian politics? The short answer is that while various traditional regimes have employed terror as a means, as an instrument or tool of oppression and intimidation, totalitarian terror is not a means at all, not a device deliberately employed by the administrators of the totalitarian regimes in order to preserve or consolidate or extend their power. On the contrary, terror must be understood as the very essence of totalitarianism, for it is through terror alone, systematically and continuously applied in the concentration camps, that the unprecedented totalitarian experiment in total domination is carried out, and the guiding conviction that everything is possible is verified. In order to clarify this central point, let's consider that form of traditional terror most often confused with totalitarian terror, the terror employed by tyrants and despots. In her brief analysis of the structure of tyranny, Arendt observes that the tyrant or despot employs terror as a means of inducing fear and anxiety in his subjects. Fear serves the tyrant's interests by clearing out the public sphere, by radically isolating individuals from one another and making them despair of the possibility for concerted action or resistance. As she observes, the terror of tyranny reaches an end once it has paralyzed or even totally dispensed with all public life and made private individuals out of all citizens, stripping them of interest in and connection with public affairs. Rule by fear, then, entrenches itself by making a desert of the common space, and thereby driving home an experience of unparalleled impotence and helplessness in its subjects. Such an experience, as Arendt acknowledges, is oppressive and suffocating. Nevertheless, it is not yet comparable to the experience of those subject to totalitarian. For as Dana Villa has pointed out, however paralyzing the fear of tyranny may be, it is still possible for those subject to it to engage in a form of strategic action. Complete obedience and the avoidance of all questionable activities may reasonably be expected to ensure one's survival. In this respect, or insofar as the spread of fear dictates a certain strategic disposition for subjects of tyranny, we may say that fear constitutes a genuine, if inherently fragile, principle of action under tyrannical regimes. If we turn now to totalitarian regimes, where terror is not merely a means to the consolidation of the ruler's power, but is the essence of the regime, things are importantly different. In its totalitarian form, terror does not aim at the clearing of the public space and the rendering impossible of public freedom. it is not satisfied to instill a paralyzing fear or to render impotent all political opposition. Indeed, totalitarian terror is by definition located beyond the logic of political opposition. As Arendt explains, quote, genuinely totalitarian terror sets in only when the regime has no more enemies who can be arrested and tortured to death, and when even the different classes of suspects are eliminated and can no longer be taken into protective custody. This feature of totalitarian terror, that it is directed against neither suspects nor enemies of the regime, but is rather turned upon absolutely innocent people who have done nothing wrong, and in the literal sense of the word, do not know why they are being arrested, sent to concentration camps, or liquidated, must be grasped if we're to acknowledge the genuinely unprecedented aim of totalitarian terror. This aim distinguishes the new regimes not only from traditional tyrannies, but from every form of political oppression hitherto encountered in the West. For as Arendt explains, totalitarianism aims at nothing less than the elimination of the incalculable itself from the human condition. Or as she says, it aims at the superfluity of human existence as such. That's the central claim, finally, that it aims at nothing less than the elimination of the incalculable itself from the human condition. In order to understand what this means and how rule by terror can succeed not only in rendering men impotent, but in rendering them absolutely superfluous, we must consider what was introduced earlier as the fundamental conviction of totalitarian rule, the conviction that everything is possible. This conviction is essentially different from the 19th century nihilistic credo, everything is permitted. This earlier credo, which underpinned the colonizing practices of imperialist regimes, is presupposed by totalitarianism, but it remains an essentially pre-totalitarian belief. The belief that everything is permitted. It's an essentially pre-totalitarian belief. It is pre-totalitarian because it remains tied to a limited understanding of political evil as an outgrowth of the immoderate passions and desires of persons in power. As Arendt says, it remains tied to the utilitarian motives and self-interest of the rulers, and thus fails to express the essentially non-utilitarian character of totalitarianism. Totalitarianism does not aim at mere conquest or expansion, and it is not primarily characterized by greed, megalomania, or the traditional tyrannical lust for power. It is not a Machiavellianism run amok, where the self-serving ends of the regime are thought to justify all manner of barbarism and brutality. Rather, the regimes are engaged in something much more ambitious and much more unsettling. They are conducting, she says, a disinterested experiment in the limits of human power. The laboratories for this experiment are the concentration camps, and the hypothesis that's being tested and verified there is that everything is possible. That is, that there are no intrinsic or built-in limits to what human beings can do to other human beings, and that by means of terror consistently applied, it is possible to reduce living human beings to wholly predictable bundles of reactions. The experiment undertaken in the camps is intended to demonstrate to the world that it is possible to strip human beings not only of their juridical status and their moral personhood, both of which are also targeted in the camps, but of individuality itself, or the very capacity to initiate action, and thus stand apart from the endless recurrence of natural life. This is the aim of totalitarian terror. But the question arises, why do the totalitarian regimes aim at the destruction of spontaneity? To what end do they conduct their experiments in human superfluity? This question might seem misguided since, as I've suggested, terror in the camps cannot be understood as a means to an end outside of it, or indeed as a means at all, but as the very essence of totalitarian rule. But one might still ask how the practitioners of terror themselves understood what was happening. How do they conceive of their own actions? In order to answer this question, we must consider the ideological superstructure of totalitarian terror. As she explains in Ideology and Terror, ideologies are instruments of total explanation. They work by positing a single idea as an axiomatic or unquestionable premise, and then unfolding it in such a way that it comprehends the totality of the historical process. Or in other words, ideologies operate by, quote, treating the course of events as though it followed the same law as the logical exposition of its idea. And in this way, they insulate their adherents from experience itself, emancipating them from the reality that we perceive with our five senses, and from the surprise and uncertainty that characterizes all human life. In the case of totalitarian ideology, the unquestioned idea in terms of which all historical happening is understood is the idea of class struggle in the case of Stalinism, or of race in the case of Nazism. Believing themselves to have discovered the immutable law of history or the immutable law of nature, the totalitarian regimes propose to make this law directly effective in the community of men. It is to this end, that is, in order to expedite and accelerate the objective law of history or nature, that they set about eliminating every possible obstacle to its realization, every possible exercise in spontaneous initiative which might upset or interfere with the smooth functioning of the law. They do this by targeting, isolating, and finally eradicating the very capacity for spontaneous action in human beings. This capacity is nothing other than the capacity to introduce something new and unexpected into the world out of one's own resources. To destroy this capacity, a capacity that, as Arendt says, is so self-evident a premise for all human relations that it would seem to transcend all merely political machinations, is to eliminate the incalculable itself from human existence. It is to reduce human beings to wholly predictable and interchangeable members of a species, which can be depended upon to react in exactly the same way, even when going to their deaths. And it's only once this is accomplished, only once the victim of terror allows himself to be led by the nose to the noose, renouncing and abandoning himself to the point of ceasing to affirm his identity, it's only then that the objective judgment of history or nature can be made absolutely effective, and reality itself transformed in accordance with the totalitarian ideology. This gloss of totalitarian ideology opens on to one of the most important features of Arendt's account, namely, the singular relation that obtains between total terror and the concept of law. According to Arendt, the exercise of terror in the camps does not simply replace an existing set of laws with its own set of policies and rules. Rather, it effects a radical transformation of the very concept of law. As she puts it, totalitarianism has exploded the very alternative on which the definitions of the nature of government have relied since the beginning of Western political thought, the alternative between lawful constitutional government on the one hand, and lawless arbitrary government on the other. Totalitarianism is lawless insofar as it defies positive law, yet it is not arbitrary insofar as it obeys with strict logic and executes with precise compulsion the laws of history or nature. So on the one hand, as she points out often, the totalitarian regimes regard all positive laws, even their own, as mere facade. While they do indeed pass new legislation, there is never any compunction about maintaining the use of terror outside of law. But this disregard for positive law, and more specifically, the legal criteria of guilt and innocence, is only the obverse of a much more intimate, positive relation to the very source of law. So far from being an exercise in lawless brutality or anarchic violence, totalitarian rule is marked by a peculiar and intense lawfulness. As she explains in Ideology and Terror, quote, it is the monstrous, unanswerable claim of totalitarian rule that far from being lawless, it goes to the sources of authority from which positive law receive their justification. That far from being arbitrary, it is more obedient to these superhuman forces than any government ever was before. And that far from wielding its power in the interest of one man, it's quite prepared to sacrifice everybody's vital, immediate interests to the execution of what it assumes to be the law of history or the law of nature. Its defiance of positive laws claims to be a higher form of legitimacy, which, since it is inspired by the source themselves, can do away with petty legality. So let me just try to clarify this very difficult point in as clear a language as I can. Right? You know, if you've seen Schindler's List, many of you will have seen Schindler's List, you'll know that one of the most unsettling moments in that film is where Ray Fiennes' character, the Nazi administrator, stands on the balcony and just sprays bullets into the field below. And that suggests that the character of the camp was kind of marked by a kind of radical arbitrariness and lawlessness and anarchy. Anything could happen at any moment. And that experience of anarchy is the fundamental feature of the camp. And of course, we know from documentary evidence that there was all kinds of lawlessness of this kind, a total disregard for any kind of positive law or rule on the part of the administrators. But what Arendt is suggesting is that it would be a terrible mistake to suppose that the camps were governed primarily by this sense of anarchy and lawlessness. That in fact, what governed the camps was an even more radical sense of lawfulness than any prior instance of political oppression. And what she means by that is the totalitarian ideologists claimed to have discovered the law itself, with a capital L, if you like. In the case of the Nazis, the law of nature. Namely, it is the law of nature for Aryan blood to ultimately emerge triumphant. Or in the case of Stalinism, the law of history. It's the law of history for lesser classes, dying classes, to die away. They discovered these laws as part of their ideology, and then they set about, if you like, expediting these laws that they had discovered in the community of men. And so what they sought was a pure, unfettered circulation of these laws in the community of human beings. And it's to that end that they set about destroying spontaneity in living human beings. Any act of spontaneity stood as a kind of impediment, right? A kind of preventative measure that would stop the law of nature or the law of history from circulating, right, unimpeded in the human community. And so they sought to essentially translate this law that they had discovered into the community of men. Now, Arendt will argue in her later theoretical writings that it belongs to all Western authoritarian regimes, that it seeks to translate some first principle or some law itself into positive laws or codes for action. But in traditional authoritarian regimes, this is done by translating the eternal law, whether it be the Ten Commandments or the Platonic Good or any number of first principles over the course of the Western tradition. Traditional authoritarian regimes translate that first principle into the human community by way of positive codes of law. What's more radical about the totalitarian regimes is they sought to simply impose the capital L law itself onto the community of human beings. Let this law circulate through and across the bodies of human beings. So the law doesn't approach human beings with reference to their will, asking them to recognize a certain law and abide by it. It rather inscribes itself on the bodies of living human beings. This is the sense in which Arendt will argue that a radical lawfulness, more radical than any in the history of Western politics for her, is what characterizes these totalitarian regimes, not simply arbitrary lawlessness where positive law is concerned. And I have so much more to say, but since I'm running out of time, let me make one last point about Arendt's account. And then hopefully we can have a conversation. It's very common to suppose that totalitarianism is best understood as an instance of extraordinary hubris and pride on the part of human beings. That what human beings sought in the totalitarian regimes was essentially to replace God. And what I've suggested so far might suggest to you that that's Arendt's view too. Because as I've suggested, her argument is that they aimed at nothing less than essentially recreating human nature, reducing living human beings to superfluity. That seems like an act of unprecedented hubris and pride. And that is true. Arendt will argue that this is this side of totalitarian terror is characterized by the most extreme hubris and pride imaginable. On the other hand, what makes her position complicated and difficult is that she is saying at the same time what they sought was not to have man replace God, but rather to reduce living human beings to, if you like, the endless recurrence of nature by reducing them to interchangeable members of the human species. So what's so complicated and difficult to think in these regimes is the coexistence of these two moments, this extraordinary hubris where we seek to remake human nature, and this extraordinary determinism and submission, where we seek to, in a way, melt into sort of pure vessels in the circulation of the law of nature or the law of history as it makes its way through the human community. Anyway, I'll stop there and thank you.